Available now from Graphic Audio.
He's done the old man proud. By leaping into the path of danger, Matt Jensen foiled a train robbery in Colorado.
We just killed the engineer. You done open that door in 5 seconds, I'll kill the fireman too.
Hold it, son of a bitch, Strayhorn. It's Jensen. Jensen's on the train.
Get the horses. Let's get out of here.
Now the governor himself has presented Matt with a public reward. But what started on the rails has now moved onto the bloody streets of the world and has taken on a life of its own.
That Jensen fella is one son of a bitch we need to avoid.
Or kill.
I'm here, Hennessy.
Well, we meet again. Only this time you don't have the drop on me. We meet even.
Not entirely even.
Now a frustrated outlaw and his murderous posse have struck again. This time, kidnapping the governor's niece.
If you scream, I'll pull the trigger. That's a good girl. Now get up.
What now?
It all depends.
It depends on what?
Whether or not the governor pays what we're gonna ask him.
Now Matt Jensen, the last mountain man, is riding hard towards an inevitable destiny. One filled with blood and death. That's where Matt will learn how to put a bad man down. And make sure he stays that way.
Damn, you're good. I thought I could beat you. I really thought.
Looks like I'm gonna need a refill, Paul. Shooting people always makes me thirsty.
Don't miss Matt Jensen's Body Count Rise in Matt Jensen, The Last Mountain Man Number 2, Deadly Train, in Graphic Audio.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's A Town Called Fury. Book 3, Judgment Day. By William W. Johnstone with J.A. Johnstone. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Danny Gavigan, Stephen Carpenter, Terrence Aselford, Sherry Simpson, David Coyne, Christopher Sheeran, James Lewis, Joe Brack, Tim Getman, Tony Nam, Casey Platt, Kate Foster, Christopher Graybill, Mort Shelby, Michael Replogle, Michael Glenn, Margie Tompros, Andy Clements, Sonny Lasky, Ken Jackson, Elliot Dash, Karen Novak, Dylan Lynch, Ted Stoddard, Nathaniel Perry, and Nanette Savard. The town of Fury sat on a large open plain in the southwest of the territory. The land about it was mostly flat, although slightly rolling, and it was cut north to south by a creek, wide and deep in winter, and barely a trickle in summer. The settlers called it Fury Creek. They had come west from Kansas City, those first settlers, and it was there that they had run across the legendary wagon master, Jedediah Fury, the man for whom they had named their town, and the man who had died at the hands of the Comanche along the way. His son carried on his legacy, however. Jason was little more than a boy when they left Kansas City, but he had taken hold like a man, shepherding the members of the train nearly to California. And once they elected him sheriff, behind his back while he lay wounded, he had to stay, despite the strong call of higher education back east and the promise of a career that did not include making himself the favorite target for every Apache or bandit that happened by. And things were about to get much, much worse. Outside the temporary Apache camp, 3 hours south of Fury, Lone Wolf rode at the head of a long line of braves, each one stripped, greased, and painted, battle-ready. They were great in number. Soaring Hawk had sent all the men he could muster on Lone Wolf's promise that this time they could not, would not fail. And Lone Wolf was a man of his word. They had come up the pass yesterday, ridden all through the day, and camped south and east of Fiery Hair's house. Not so close that they could be detected, but not so far away that they hadn't taken two of Fiery Hair's cattle and cooked them for an evening meal. Fiery Hair had good cattle, even if he was white, and even if he was a fool. The whites had done nothing to them, but just the fact that they existed was a thorn in the side of Soaring Hawk and Lone Wolf. They would take Fiery Hair and his woman after they took the town, and they would return with many tales to tell, and many cattle, and many ponies. They would return to Soaring Hawk in honor. Fury, Arizona Territory. Jason ducked just in time to avoid catching a slug with his face. As he scurried backward deeper into the alley, he wiped at his cheek. His hand came away bloody and bearing ragged splinters.
Damn it, Saul, you nearly got me!
Jason jumped behind a stack of packing crates. For the fourth time, he stopped himself before his fingers could curl around its butt. Saul might have temporarily gone peach-ordered crazy, but Jason didn't have to. For a while, anyway. But if Saul took one more shot at him...
Saul! Saul, it's Dr. Morelli!
Jason felt relieved despite himself. He thought that everybody had taken to the hills, or at least the wagons outside the wall, a while back. At least he figured the smart ones had. Morelli was inside the stable and across the square, so far as Jason could figure.
Jason! Jason, are you all right?
Been better. Might be bleeding to death.
Saul, stop it!
As deadly as the situation might seem, Jason had more important things on his mind, and Saul's momentary descent into madness was just one more thing to take care of. After all, Saul couldn't help it, Jason supposed. A man could scarcely be expected to deal with two children being born full-term dead inside 2 years. If he were Saul, Jason reasoned, he'd probably shoot up a town or two as well. The street was quiet again, and Jason ventured forward to the alley's mouth, a few tentative feet at a time. He showed his face at the corner, then stepped into full view. Nothing. No slug sang past his ears or pierced his flesh. Saul's wilding time was over.
Doc? I reckon he's finished.
Dr. Morelli stepped forward through the door of the livery and held up his hand to Jason, waving it. After a moment, he turned to his left and began to walk up the street.
Saul! Saul, where are you, old man?
Saul must have answered, although too softly for Jason to hear across the street, because Doc Morelli stopped, shook his head, then opened the door of the mercantile and disappeared inside. Jason started back toward his office. By the time he reached the northwest corner of the square and crossed the street to the jail, he glanced back and saw Doc Morelli guiding a hunched Saul Cohen back up to his hardware store.
Hope Doc gives you a big dose of that sleep juice of his, Saul. About 2 days' worth.
Jason opened the door and let himself into his office. He settled down behind the desk, thumbed his hat back, and pulled open the top drawer.
Now, back to the important stuff.
Along about 11:30, red-headed Megan McDonald, sister of the town's young banker, Matt, rode through the stockade gate into Fury and made her way up the street to the sheriff's office. She seemed, to anyone watching, to be riding with a purpose. Her freckled face was set with a furrowed brow, her legs were stiff in the stirrups, and she sat in the saddle as if someone had sewn an iron rod into the back of her dress. She dismounted before the office, tied her horse to the rail with a quick but decisive twist of the reins, and marched to the door. It was open, and Jason was behind the desk, practically buried in papers. Megan let the door slam behind her and stood there, her posture just as stiff as it had been all the way into town, just as stiff as it had been since she woke once again to the sound of angry voices. Jason's head lifted, but the smile didn't stay on his lips for very long.
Megan, what's wrong?
As if you didn't know.
Megan, I've been sort of busy this morning, and I...
Oh, no, you don't, Jason Fury. We've been over and over this, and don't pretend you don't know exactly what I'm talking about. You got to do something about Matt and Jenny.
Megan, you know I predicted this from the start, but Jenny's the one who has to decide whether or not she wants out, either she or Matt. I've told you, and I told Jenny, that I'm not going to meddle in their business. I haven't since they got hitched, and I won't start now.
Jason had told Jenny all right. Told her on her wedding day. She'd made her bed, and now she'd have to lie in it. It didn't sound like she was finding it any too comfortable either. Megan appeared to relax just a bit. At least part of the starch seemed to go out of her spine, and she sat down on the wooden chair opposite his before her shoulders collapsed into a dejected slouch.
Megan. Megan, honey, I know it's hard, believe me.
Oh, that's so easy for you to say, Jason. I can see I won't make any progress here. Excuse me, I have errands.
When Saul was finally down and sleeping next to his wife upstairs, Doc Morelli had quietly let himself out the front door, checking to make sure the closed sign was visible before he locked the door and pocketed the key. As he was walking up the street, he had seen Megan's dramatic exit from the office, but by the time he reached the door she'd slammed out of, she had remounted and ridden past him at a fast clip. He thought she was going to speed it up into a gallop when she passed the break in the wall that opened onto the vast prairie outside of town, but instead she reined in next to it and tied her horse. She walked around the corner and headed toward the wagons that had parked south of the wall yesterday. As angry as Megan looked, she was going shopping? He wondered as he reached for the sheriff's office door. He surely wouldn't want to be a vendor this morning. He pushed down the door latch and let himself in.
Now what? Sorry, Doc. Have a seat.
No, can't stay. Just had a bit of business to take care of. That's to Cohen's Hardware. I just got Saul put to bed.
Medicated?
Oh, Lord. It took half a bottle just to knock him off his feet. Jason, don't hold it against him. What happened this morning, I mean? You've got to feel sorry.
Don't worry about it, Doc. I forgot about it already.
You're wise beyond your years, Jason.
Go on, Doc. Get out of here. Heck, I'll go with you.
Morelli smiled despite himself while Jason came around the desk to join him. It was odd, especially with Morelli being Jason's senior, but at times the doctor felt strangely the junior of the two. He supposed this had something to do with Jason's having shepherded him and all the others in the original wagon train clear out from Indian Territory after the death of Jason's father, Jedediah. Still, it was rather peculiar.
Hungry yet?
Morelli glanced at the office clock. 11:45.
It's a little early for me.
Tad early for me, too, come to think of it. See you later, Doc.
West of the Santa Rita Mountains, a few days east of Fury. Richard Blake, a short, stocky pilgrim with his rifle at his side and his old, worn Bible beneath his jolting seat, drove the lead wagon in the tiny train, headed west for greener pastures. His wife Laura sat beside him, holding their first baby, the newly born Seth. Blake felt bad about that. He had promised his wife that they'd be long settled by the time the baby came. Laura had voiced no complaint, though, God bless her. She was a treasure. His treasure.
Yeah? No.
As she cuddled the infant, he smiled. A man who had just come east from California had told him of a town not too far distant, a town called Fury. He'd said it was much smaller than Tucson, if a fellow was looking for that, and that they had most of the modern conveniences, a doctor, teachers for the children, a good well in the center of town, and so on. There was already a preacher, he'd said, but not even half the town went to hear him preach. And after the man confided in Blake at length, Blake understood why. So Blake was thinking that perhaps Fury was the place for him and Laura to set down some roots. He'd said nothing to either Laura or their companions, though. If Carlyle was his middle name, then Caution was his nickname. Blake normally rode his saddle horse Buck, but he'd opted to drive the wagon today so as to allow Laura to devote all her time to the baby. Buck was happily tied to the rear of the wagon, following along. The morning was clear, the horizons were empty, and the world was before him. He led the other wagons onward, westward, toward Fury. The town had been in existence only a scant 2 years, built by the bare hands of pioneers, where before there had only been a broad desert prairie sliced vertically by a lonely and sporadically flowing creek. Distant veiled mountains rose to the south, beyond which lay Mexico. To the north, even more distant mountains lined the horizon. Fury was the name the townsfolk had given the small settlement, in honor of the famous wagon master who had started them westward. Now, nearly 2 years since the first walls of the new buildings had risen, since Saul Cohen had begun work on what now served as the town well centering the square, and since the partially built town itself had been attacked and burned by Apaches who rode in from the south, Fury had risen from the ashes, bigger and bolder than ever before. But men had been lost to the Apaches on that day. Others had been wounded, including Jason himself, who had been appointed town sheriff while he lay injured and unable to defend himself from his friends in town. Jason's life had taken a new path that day, although he could barely know the beginnings of it. He still couldn't possibly guess at the whole of it. Since the day of the attack, the people of Fury had been busy building it back and building it bigger and better. In the process, some people had died and others had moved on. And some had traveled south in pursuit of a thieving gang of Mexican bandits, but enough had stayed and been joined by new influxes of pilgrims and wanderers that the population had nearly doubled in size, the building boom had continued, and an outer stockade-type wall now completely surrounded the town. Those who wanted to live outside the confines of the town did so more easily than ever, since there had been no more trouble from the Apache. Close to town, anyway. Jason had even taken care of Juan Alba and his bandidos last year. At least he thought he had. Today, the mail had come in, and Prescott had sent out word that a new Juan Alba, taking the place of the old one, was on the prowl. Juan Jr., or something like that, Jason reasoned. Like father, like son. Jason had given up on trying to go west to San Francisco, on trying to go anywhere that held anything like a college. He figured to be stuck with Sheriffing Fury, trapped forever as surely as an unlucky butterfly pinned to a display board. And he was at least partially right. Jason stood near the stockade entrance thinking, why wasn't he braver? Why couldn't he just tell the mayor and the citizens to go to hell? Why couldn't he just pack up a satchel and leave like other people did? Well, some other people. On the whole, the town was actually growing. Some folks headed back east, some headed farther west, but miraculously, more rode into their little town than rode out. And they stayed.
Idiots.
Jason walked toward the first wagon. He didn't make it, though.
Ow! Damn it!
Mayor Salmon Kendall, carrying a couple of 2x4s, walked straight into Jason. The boards hit Jason in the forehead and shoulder and knocked him back a few feet.
Oh, Jason, I'm so very sorry. You all right?
Been better. What's your rush this morning?
I just talked to Doc Morelli. Heard about your run-in with Saul Cohen.
Nah, it was nothing. Doc's got him doped up and at home.
But your cheek's cut.
Probably looks worse than it is.
Well, but still.
I'm fine, Salmon. Just gonna go down and check on our guests.
You mean you haven't been down there yet? Take my advice, boy, and don't take your wallet along. I left with $15 worth of stuff I'll never use.
But you left with a happy wife, though.
Well, true. True enough, Jason. Come to think of it, most of the haul was women's stuff. You know, pickled dishes and butter plates and such. And shrimp forks. I ask you, where in tarnation does Carrie think we're going to run across any shrimp out here?
Don't know. There aren't even any crawdads in the creek. When there's water in it, that is. Maybe you can fork yourself up some teensy tiny little lizard eggs.
See you later, funny man. I'm not going to offer myself up to be robbed blind again.
All right, see you later, Mayor Shrimp Fork.
Very funny. Very funny.
The mayor turned and walked away back into town. A smirking Jason made his way down the long line of Conestogas, edging the outer wall of the town. It seemed that the entire population of Fury was out here with him. Some clustered in knots around the dropped and propped tailboards of wagons, the children darting in and out between the heavily loaded Conestogas. Jason had spoken briefly with the wagon master, an affable chap named Fred Barlow, the night before when the wagons pulled in. Barlow was more than content to park his wagons outside the wall and seemed grateful to have found a town out here, any town. At the moment, though, Barlow was nowhere in sight. The citizens of Fury, however, had been out in full force since the crack of dawn. Jason wouldn't be a bit surprised to find the town well-draped in silver tassels and dangling shrimp forks come morning.
Why, Jason Fury.
He turned toward the voice and spied Abigail Crimp, already dressed in her spangles and carting enough loot to stagger a stevedore. She grinned widely.
I got up early to shop, and I'm so glad that I...
Jason!
Wash Keogh, who to the best of Jason's knowledge was supposed to be far out of town and working his claim, came barreling toward him and reined in his horse in a roil of hoof-raised dust.
Wash! What are you doing?
Engine station! It's Apache! And they're coming your way in a big hurry!
You've been sipping at some of that homemade cactus whiskey of yours?
You deaf or something, boy! I just told you Apaches, and they ain't far out of town! You gotta get these folks inside where it's safe! You gotta man the turrets! You gotta get...
Man the turrets?
Well, hell, boy, get some fellas up top on the wall at least and haul these wagons inside. Get these critters moving. Don't you know? All they are is Apache ladders.
As hysterical as Wash appeared, Jason couldn't smell any mezcal on him. Quickly, Jason leapt to the seat of the closest wagon, standing on it to get as high as he could. He stood there a moment facing south, his back to Wash. He hoped that Wash was dead wrong, but the truth was that there was a dust cloud to the south. A dust cloud that was rapidly approaching Fury. He whirled around and jumped to the ground.
Hey! Everybody, listen up. There's Apache on the way. Everybody inside the town walls, you men go get your guns. You in the wagons. Circle your wagons around the well inside the walls. Apache! Apache coming in fast! Come on, hurry up, folks. Move it!
Jason ran toward the south gate of town. There he found Megan's horse and galloped back outside again through the stampede of men, women, children, and wagons coming swiftly toward him in the gate.
You there! Drive your wagon toward the well!
Jason spun outside the mass of wagons to get a look at the horizon. They were closer now, almost close enough to make out individuals without the aid of binoculars, and through his mind raced the image of his sister out at the McDonald's place. He prayed that she was all right, that she'd hidden, or that the Braves were too intent on reaching the town in the wagons to bother with a meager homestead.
Jason!
It was Ward Wanamaker running toward him down the center of West Main, his gun drawn. Since Jenny had married and moved out, Ward had been renting her room. Jason believed in keeping his deputy close at hand.
See to the wagons!
Jason wheeled his mount back across the square to Dr. Morelli's door. He didn't have to knock, let alone dismount. Morelli was hurrying out the door when he got there.
Apache!
In reply, the doctor nodded quickly and reached back inside the door for his rifle and his medical bag.
Get your wife and kids to the center of the square!
Jason wheeled the horse once more and headed up toward Cohen's Hardware. If those Indians made it over the wall, he didn't want the first screams to come from Olympia and Doc's kids, let alone Saul and Rachel Cohen's. Once he skidded Megan's mount to a halt and tossed the reins around the rail, he banged at the glass out front of Salmon Kendall's mercantile until Salmon's head appeared at the bottom of the steps. Then Jason made a sign, fingers for feathers, at the back of his head.
Honey, quick! Get the kids and head the heck downstairs! Apache!
Jason took off for the Cohen store next door. He figured they were probably both out like snuffed candles, but he had to get both of them and their kids downstairs. Jason unlocked, then pushed in the front door, and raced past shelves bulging with hardware items and took the stairs two at a time.
I tell you, I'm pretty sure they passed us by.
Inside the hidey hole beneath the main room of their home, Matt stood atop the ladder. His ear, attached to a head full of red hair as fiery as his sister's, was still pressed to the floorboards above him, and his attractive brow was still knotted with concentration. Below, on the dirt floor, sat the former Jenny Fury, now Jenny McDonald. Her long, slender legs were crossed Indian style, and her arms were crossed, too. She didn't answer him. Everything about her body posture said no. Actually, everything about it said go to hell, but that flew past Matt's understanding, as did most everything about his wife. Jenny had learned that he didn't care. He didn't care about much of anything that didn't concern him directly and personally, and right now, his wife was not one of those things.
Jenny, did you hear me? I said I'm pretty sure—
Shh!
The idiot. Didn't he know the Indians could be up there right now? One of their heathen ears pressed to the other side of that floorboard? Her hands gripped her arms tighter, and she felt herself shiver. Oh, how she wished she'd gone into town with Megan this morning. She would have liked to have seen her brother Jason one more time, if this was indeed her day to die. Matt, now silent, came back down the ladder, unhooked the lantern, and carried it over. He sat down beside her, the lantern light washing over his hair and face. Jenny saw his hands tremble. He was scared. Not just scared of the Indians, scared of everything. Perhaps even a little frightened of her. She bit back the smile that threatened to pop out. Now was not the time for grinning like a fool. But she had suddenly realized why her husband could be, and usually was, such an ass. She supposed he was like a cur dog who snapped and growled at the person who tried to feed it. What had happened to make him so afraid? She shook her head. It didn't matter. She supposed it didn't even matter what had spooked him so bad. Probably when he was just a kid. Probably something to do with that father of his. But it didn't matter. What mattered right at this particular moment was keeping him from opening that trap door until she was absolutely positive that the danger had passed. And she wasn't sure. Not yet. Having gotten a doped and unconscious Saul, an equally drugged Rachel and their boys down the stairs and into the store's back room, Jason had left them all in the storeroom before he started for the saloon. Outside, the town square rang with gunfire, and Jason was narrowly missed by an arrow, which instead of clipping him in the neck, buried itself in the side of Cohen's hardware. The roof of Reverend Milcher's church was already afire, he noticed, as he made his way along the sidewalk. Nobody was putting that out, but he saw that Ward Wanamaker was passing buckets along a line to the roof of the livery stable, which was also ablaze. Several of the newcomers were also helping with the stable, leading animals out and pitching them across the way, north of the town square. Somebody had best see to the church, Jason thought as he ducked into the saloon. Inside, he saw Abigail peeking over the bar top.
Jason!
Down!
Her head disappeared behind the bar like a pond turtle's into its shell. Raleigh Bigston, the cockney from California with whom Abigail was now in business, had vacated completely, but bartender Gil Collins was at the window, watching the top of the wall and shooting any poor savage who managed to climb to the top. So far as Jason could tell, no Indian had yet made it over alive. Gil picked off yet another warrior coming over the gate.
Good man, Gil. Fish in a barrel, Sheriff.
Gil paused a moment to reload his rifle. Jason drew and shot over Gil's head, picking off a warrior who'd been right behind the one Gil had hit. The body toppled backward and out of sight.
Thanks, Jason. Sneaky critters, ain't they?
They surely are. If you're all right in here, I'm going to help with the fire at the church.
Go on, then.
Jason didn't get a chance to see who Gil was aiming at, or whether his shot had struck its target. He just ran like the devil was after him, ran through a barrage of arrows, and all the way across the street toward the flaming corner church.
Quick! Children, run! Run!
The Milcher kids had been hurried across the way by their mother, and Jason gave them a reassuring wave as he scurried past. Then the horses and wagons ringing the center well blocked the sight of them, and he was in front of the church. Everybody was still hard at work passing buckets toward the stable, but he got Salmon Kendall's attention.
Half of the church!
Quick! Every other man make a second line to the west at Milcher's church!
Someday that's when I'm gonna take my advice and not build that sarn thing so damn high.
Jason grabbed a full bucket from the closest man and made for the church doors. Inside, he found that the flames hadn't worked their way down to the first floor yet, but the smoke certainly had. Reverend Milcher was stretched out behind his pulpit, unconscious and covered with ash. An empty bucket lay beside his hand. First things first. Jason set down his bucket, tied his bandana over his mouth and nose, and proceeded to drag Nutcher outside. Mayor Kendall and a new face greeted him outside. Both men were carrying buckets, and Kendall had his halfway to the ground before Jason waved him off.
Second floor!
He dragged Milcher as far as he could, which was just to the other side of the circled wagons, and left him to regain consciousness in his wife's arms.
Oh, bless you, Jason, bless you!
Then Jason sprinted back across the way. The bucket line had reached the front of the church by now, and Jason arrived just in time to grab a full one from the front man, an enormous black man built like a stevedore and stripped to the waist.
Thanks.
Jason took the bucket and headed toward the stairs at the backside of the first floor. The smoke was thick, and it stung his eyes and nose as he felt his way up the steps. He bumped into somebody on his way up. Salmon, he thought, squinting against the smoke, but he kept moving until he reached the top landing at the Milchers' living quarters. The place was ablaze. Rugs sprouted flames like prairie sprouts grass. The sofa and chairs pocked the room like burning brush, and the heavier pieces, the brake front and dining table and some wooden shelving, smoked in some places, flickered with infant flame in others. Jason didn't take the time to pick a target. He simply threw his bucket of water toward the couch, barely seeing the water fly through the smoke-filled room. But he heard it hit the target. And immediately he turned on his heel and found his way back to the stairs. Halfway down, he ran into someone coming up. Salmon again. Wordlessly, through the roiling smoke, he traded buckets with the mayor and started back up the steps. Outside Fury's walls and at the top of a distant rise, Lone Wolf waited for his captains to return to him for a parley while he watched the battle. It was not going well. In fact, it was going very poorly. The whites picked off his men from the top of their wall like his forefathers had once picked off the mighty grazing buffalo from the cover of long grass. Juanito, who had returned limping badly, a bullet embedded in his thigh, stood next to Lone Wolf.
I thought you said you had scouted.
I did, just last week.
Lone Wolf had, too. All was just as he'd seen it, except for those big wagons they'd just observed hurrying to the relative safety of the inner wall. Lone Wolf knew they were freighters, daring to cart their wares across Apache land. And from past experience, he knew what they carried. He smiled to himself. Very soon, there would be new toys for the children and pretty cloth for the women. And the Apache would all have a rich supply of cattle and pigs and flour and salt to last through the summer and winter, and new ponies.
Your information was not very good.
It was not good, Lone Wolf. The walls are too high for such men as we. It would take men the size of gods to step over them.
So said Ravenlitz. He said, then I will be that tall and stood on his pony. He lies where they shot him off.
Pick up the dead and bring them back. The wounded too, but do not stop the fight. We can win, you and you. Take your men to the side of the town where Earth greets the sun. Attack strongly. You, Bobcat who snarls, you get back to the gate. Juanito, get yourself to the medicine man. Tell him I said to mend your leg before you go back to battle.
Juanito left him, awkwardly hobbling toward the medicine man. Lone Wolf glanced to the west. The sun was falling close to the horizon. There would be not much time left for fighting today. Victory might have to be left for tomorrow. If this was the case, so be it. Ward Wanamaker, the town's deputy and the man who would organize the bucket brigades once the wagons were all inside and the stockade closed up against the heathen, was busily hauling bucket after bucket up from the well. It was no easy feat because the water level was rapidly falling. He knew that if they didn't get these fires put out pretty quickly, they were going to have to let the fires have their way. He didn't want that. His back aching, Ward hauled up another bucket, handed it to the next man in line, and sent down an empty. It was halfway to its target when he felt the arrow sink into his shoulder with a sharp sting. Then, a burning ache. He fell to his knees, and then face forward into the dirt of the street. His bucket rope was grabbed by someone. He couldn't see who.
Get me up! Get me on my feet! Get me up!
No one listened. Not even his own body. Jenny looked up sharply, and Matt fairly leapt to his feet. Both didn't respond, though, waiting to see if the knuckle wrapper had a blade in his spear or an arrow, or if he was friendly.
Mr. McDonald? Ma'am? You folks down there?
Yes, Curly. Hang on, just gotta throw this bolt.
One-handed, Matt slid free the 4x4 beam that secured the trap door, then gingerly opened it upward. Curly beamed down at them, relief coloring his freckled cheeks.
Sure glad to find you folks all right.
After making way to let Matt climb up, Curly stuck his arm down toward Jenny. It figured that Matthew wouldn't give her a second glance of concern, let alone a first one, Jenny thought. Had her mother ever felt this way about her father? She hoped not, and if she was wrong about her folks, she sure hoped that they'd had a nice hired man or two around, like Curly. He helped her up the steps, then shyly let go and took a step backward.
Thank you, Curly.
At
least Curly acknowledged that she was there, she thought. Matt was at the front window.
They went right past us. They're burning the town.
Jenny looked past his shoulder and saw the smoke rising up north.
Not the whole town. It's just the church again, like 2 years ago.
Jenny had been in town the last time the Apache had come. Then they'd set the church ablaze and shot her brother. But the town hadn't had the stockade up back then. She told herself that everyone was fine and that the Apache were fighting a losing battle, and that her brother had everything under control. For once, she was glad that her husband didn't go into town on Saturdays. Jason probably already had enough on his plate without Matthew elbowing his way in. Jason was at the top of the eastern portion of the stockade, emptying his rifle at a swarm of Apache, a knot of them really, who had attempted to break through the stockade wall. Now, three of them lay dead outside it. A fourth clung to his pony's mane, his blood flowing down over the horse's withers and front legs, like red war paint. Jason raised the muzzle of his rifle and relaxed a hair as the fifth and sixth warriors rode away, their bloody comrade and his pony between them. Dr. Morelli climbed up the ladder and stepped up to the plank that supported Jason.
How's it going?
I doubt anybody will try to come in this way again for at least 10-15 minutes.
It seems to me to be getting a little quieter down at the south wall.
Don't doubt it. It'll be all the way dark in about a half hour or so. How many wounded do we have?
Only half a dozen, unless somebody else took an arrow while I was making my way over here. Nothing serious. I think your deputy got the worst of it. But that was only because he was plenty sore already and he tensed up. Around the arrow, I mean. Took it in the back.
How's he doing?
Fine now. Had to dope him up to keep him down, though. You know how he is.
He's a tough old pelican.
Not so old, Jason. I take it you don't need me distracting you?
Jason glanced out over the stockade. The wounded brave and his escort had ridden out of sight, and the bodies on the ground lay still.
Hold up. I'll go with you.
Jason followed Morelli down to the ground, and they started back toward the center of the square. Jason imagined that the rest of the attacking force was pulling out until first light.
Help me pick some boys to stand night watch, will you?
Sure.
And I don't think everybody older than I am is ready for a rocking chair.
Good thing.
Well, I don't.
Morelli and Jason assigned the least fatigued men to lookout posts around the stockade. The arrows had long since ceased to fly by the time they finished assigning duty for the first and second shifts, and Olympia Morelli and several other women were busy preparing a communal supper over a fire someone had built in the town square. Megan McDonald was among them, and in spite of the scene she'd put on this morning, Jason was mightily relieved to see her there, and to see that she was unharmed. He had no chance to speak to her, however, because Morelli dragged him over to the sheriff's office. Ward Wanamaker was inside, in a cell, his back and shoulders swathed in bandages.
Hope you don't mind, Jason, but I put him here. The cot in the other cell's for you.
What's wrong with my house?
It's full of milchers.
Huh?
I know you put the fire out, but the second floor didn't look safe to me. Actually, the steeple bell had already fallen through the ceiling, along with half the steeple. Or what was left of it. And directly onto somebody's bed. Lucky that he or she wasn't in it. And really, the first floor didn't seem any too stable either.
And here I thought we did such a good job.
Oh, you did. Yeah, you did. But I just didn't want to take any chances. And I didn't think you'd mind.
What about him? You give him enough dope to carry him through the night?
I think so. If he wakes, you can always whack him over the skull with the butt of your gun.
The wagon train, east of Fury. Olin Whaler walked up to the lead wagon and looked up at Richard Blake. Olin drove the second wagon of the train, which was pulled by four massive mules, each one just as stubborn as Olin. Olin had dreams of California gold, or silver. It didn't much matter to him.
I wish the heck you'd stop yelling, "Circle the wagons," when you want to stop.
Why?
A body can't circle four wagons, that's why. Maybe five? Now for sure six, but not four.
We can sort of circle them, Olin. Basically, I want everybody in a tight group. You can understand that, can't you?
Oh, stop it, Rev.
Olin had been a thorn in his side since he joined the group back in Santa Fe. Olin thought that because he was Catholic, he didn't know Richard Blake a doggone thing, let alone the respect that Blake was fairly sure he deserved as a man of God, and which he got from everyone else. Frankly, Blake thought he'd like to give Olin a good swat with that Bible Olin was always accusing him of thumping.
Olin, as long as I'm in charge of this little train, we'll do things my way. And when I yell, "Circle the wagons," I mean for you to circle them as tightly as you can. Or square them up, whichever configuration you care to convert it to. Understand?
Don't press your luck, darling.
Blake knew that she meant that Olin was at least 6'3", had no respect for him, and had a bad temper to boot. But Blake stood his ground and said a silent prayer.
Dear Father in Heaven, please get this big lummox to listen without hitting.
God must have been paying attention because Olin angrily stared at him a moment longer, then turned on his heel and stalked off toward his wagon and his family.
Shall Becky and I start gathering firewood?
Yes, that would be a good idea. Here, I'll take the baby. Watch out for snakes.
Don't forget the spiders.
And spiders.
Blake waved at Randy Mankiller, the only one of the men looking his way to come along. Laura and Becky couldn't get enough wood by themselves. In fact, he'd be surprised if they could find any at all out here. The view to the horizon was clear in all directions. No trees, living or dead. Randy, a lanky part Cherokee, who originally came from northern Texas, joined him at a trot.
What you need, Reverend?
Want to help me fetch some wood, Randy?
Not really, but I reckon I'm game.
Just what I like to hear. The game part, anyhow.
I hear you, Reverend. You think we're actually gonna find any downed trees out here?
Randy, I'm hoping that the Lord will provide.
Fury. At 11 that night, his belly bursting with Olympia Morelli's good beef stew and biscuits, Jason finally fell asleep in the second cell, despite Ward's heavy snores.
Hey!
Jason was awakened at 1:30 by someone shaking him and kicking the frame of his cot.
What?
Jason opened his eyes just in time to see a figure fall back into the bars of the cell. He swung his legs off the side of the cot, then struck a match to reveal a man in boots and pants, not an Apache. Jason lit the lantern he'd carried inside. When he turned up the wick, he saw Ward Wanamaker sitting on the floor opposite him, slouched forward, one arm crossed over his chest and pressed to the bandages that swathed his shoulder and back. Jason leapt to his feet and knelt beside his deputy.
Aw, crud, Ward. You all right? Didn't know it was you.
Didn't know it was you either. Oh, what happened, Jason?
On your feet first.
Jason helped him back up and back to his own cell. Slowly, he lowered Ward to his own cot and helped him stretch out.
All right, better? What happened is that you took an arrow and Doc patched you up. Then they moved you in here and gave you enough painkiller to make a half-grown bullock sleep for a week straight.
The Indian's gone? You take care of him?
No. The night took care of him, but they'll be back come sunup if I'm any judge.
You send for the cavalry?
You know it'd take a week for them to get here. Either we'll all be dead by that time or the Apache will.
Okay.
Get some shut-eye for now.
You'll wake me for the next fight.
The minute we need you.
Okay.
Next time I'm gonna have to tell Morelli to give you enough for a full-grown bull.
Down at the McDonald Ranch, Jenny had insisted that they sleep down in the hidden compartment beneath the living room of the house. Matt had fought her on it, but not very hard, she noted. He was asleep across the way, snugged into his blankets. How nice that he could sleep. Through the darkness, Jenny made a face at him. Everything was quiet so far. The night was still, and she knew that Curly was secreted in the bunkhouse hidey hole too, along with the other hands, Carlos and Wilmer. She supposed that she should feel safe, but she knew that if the Apache set fire to the place, they were locked in down here and likely doomed. It wasn't the most pleasant outcome, and she hoped that the Apache would ride off on the same trail they'd used to ride up to Fury. It would swing them far out to the east. Close enough that their dust cloud could be seen by anyone at the ranch, but far enough to hide her and hers from the naked Apache eye. She hoped. Not being able to sleep herself, Jenny tried listing the things that they'd brought down with them, in hopes of saving them in case the Apache torched the house. She hadn't been able to bring the piano, more's the pity, or her mother's brake front. Just small things, Matthew had insisted, and in this case, he'd been right. So they'd brought along his important papers, the one he usually kept at the bank, and the jewelry and the silverware. They had also brought plenty of water, a thunder bucket, a bag filled with foodstuffs, and enough kerosene to last them through several days and nights, should it come to that. She hoped it wouldn't, but it was best to be prepared. She had sent food, water, and kerosene to the bunkhouse with Curly, too. What was he saying in his sleep? She shrugged beneath her blankets. It was probably some girl's name if she knew him. And she'd learned all his tricks this last nearly 2 years. And he knew that she knew, not that he'd ever admit it. She stared up toward the ceiling, up toward the trapdoor and the crossbar that secured it in place.
If I had half the guts my brother thinks I do, I'd climb up and open that door.
But she didn't. She'd learned that long ago. If she was braver and not half so silly, she'd still be single and living in town with Jason.
Oh.
She closed her eyes and fell slowly into a fitful sleep.
What is wrong with us?
Lone Wolf stared around him. All about him, braves were licking their wounds, tending their dead. The medicine man and his potions were in heavy demand. They had lost many ponies, too. How could they attack without ponies? When he had last scouted the whites in their town, things had been much different. The walls had not looked that high from a distance. They had not been so heavily armed. He had imagined that they would give in more easily. He had been wrong, but he could not admit as much. The war chief could never be wrong. When the sun rose the next morning, Jason was outside on the wall along with Saul Cohen. Saul was in a much better mood this morning, all things considered. The Apache were already not only awake, but attacking the fortress that Fury citizens had made of the town. The Apache hadn't succeeded in setting anything ablaze yet, unless you counted Gil Collins. On his way from the outhouse back to his post of yesterday, Gil had caught a flaming arrow in the side. Fortunately, somebody got him put out right away and called for the doc. Morelli started his day off by pulling the arrowhead out of Gil and treating his burns. But the arrow hadn't sunk in deeply, and Gil was back at his post, picking off the few Apache that dared a chance climbing the gate today.
Jason, I want to apologize for yesterday.
You're having one hell of a rotten day, Saul. Forget it. I'm awful sorry that Rachel lost the baby.
Thank you, Jason, but I...
Never mind, I said.
Jason turned and fired again, but failed to hit anything.
Damn it.
He crouched down and began to reload the rifle.
Where do you want me?
Here would be good. How's she feeling? Rachel, I mean.
She will survive.
Good. Glad to hear it.
They were outstandingly fortunate because the wagon from which his townspeople had purchased doilies and fish forks and china dolls and the occasional guitar also contained a number of other things, including a load of ammunition. They were making good use of it now. Jason brought his rifle up again just as Saul swung his rifle between the tops of the sharpened stockade logs and an Apache fell from his pony. Dust puffed up around the body, momentarily obscuring it.
You'd think they'd learn.
Learn what?
That bullets hurt.
Jason fired, and this time the brave he'd aimed at fell. Jason took aim again. The Apache vaulted from his pony just as Jason pulled the trigger, and he missed. How many of them were there anyway? It seemed that no matter how many they killed, they just kept coming.
How many are there?
Don't know. I think it's a swarm, like locusts.
It's a plague of locusts. A swarm of flies, a plague of locusts.
Oh. Nice shot.
He wasn't the one I was aiming at.
Down at Jason's house, the Reverend Milcher, along with his wife Lavinia and their brood of children, were huddled in the kitchen. The two smallest were beneath the table, hands over their ears as if they could block out the sound of gunshots from outside. Milcher's fist clenched tightly around the stock of his rifle, which had been across his lap unfired since they rose.
Samuel, can't you do something?
I am doing something. I am protecting my family.
But they are all a...
Hush, wife! They'll need me more later. At present, I can do them little good, accepting my prayers.
Yes, dear.
We could all use some food.
They were all a jitter, and they'd been that way since yesterday. The only one of them who was unaffected was little Oliver, only because he was just 8 months old. But even Oliver knew something evil was in the air, that someone was out there doing Satan's work. He'd been fussing constantly over the last 24 hours, which she supposed had frayed her nerves, as if they weren't frayed enough already. Perhaps Samuel was right.
Some lunch, Lavinia?
Sheriff Fury doesn't have much on hand. I think I can make soup, though.
Fine soup.
Mama, I want to go home now, please.
We have no home to go to.
Don't worry. Hush, my darling, don't fret. The good Lord will provide.
By 3 that afternoon, Jason had finished his third tour of the perimeter. The Apache still hadn't come at them from the north, and the occasional weak assaults from the west side, the side of the stockade that ran parallel to the creek, remained just that, occasional and weak. Jason wasn't concerned about attacks from the west. The banks of the stream were steep and still slick with the retreating water's mud. Additionally, there was no gate on that side, and therefore no specific weak point for the Apaches to attack. Jason was worried about the north. Although their losses were small compared to those they were inflicting upon the heathen horde, there seemed to be an inexhaustible supply of them, as if God had given the Apache a man-sized rubber stamp with which to create new warriors as they needed them. Jason was just a little miffed at God for the time being, but he had an idea, one he'd conjured in a moment of brilliance, and as he made his way back around to the south, he talked with the men on the wall. They were all tired, so tired, as was he, but still up for the fight. He was proud of them. He'd gathered plenty of volunteers as he made the circuit, and already a crowd, men and horses alike, was beginning to form up at the northern gate. His townsmen might be exhausted, but they were out for blood. And they were too weakened by gun smoke and the steadily beating sun and the sounds and smells of battle and blood to give much of a damn for life or death anymore. He knew just what they were feeling. He was feeling it too. So he gathered together those men who were willing, there at the north gate. They had their orders, and each man was mounted on his or a buddy's fastest horse. All were heavily armed and steely-nerved. At the head of the mob, Jason looked at the kid standing at the gate's latch. He had already freed the crossbeam. Jason nodded.
Now, Bill.
Young Bill McAllister slipped the latch and jumped atop the gate's foothold to swing it back. Suddenly, the way was clear. 30 armed riders burst through the gate into the clear, 15 of them barreling immediately to the east. Jason and the others waited until the first bunch turned south at the far eastern corner of the stockade, then kicked their own horses in the opposite direction. They turned at the corner of the stockade and rode south along the narrow path between the outer wall and the creek bank, as if Old Scratch himself was on their tails. They emerged into the open at the same time as the first 15 riders and galloped toward the middle, relentlessly scattering or cutting down any Indians in their path. The men on the wall held their fire for the moment, and Jason rode his mare Cleo with her reins clenched in his teeth. Both of his hands were busy with a rifle, which barked repeatedly. The riders' weapons belched sparks and smoke and bullets that spelled the end of many an Apache warrior. The remaining Apache, taken by surprise, were easily routed. Easily, that is, if one didn't count the losses to the town. But Jason had no time to grieve over, much less notice the losses. The only thought on his mind, and the minds of his men, was to kill as many Apache as possible. And that they proceeded to do, mindless of the toll it took on their own ranks. And they chased the horde away to the southeast, chased them so fast and furiously that the dust cloud raised by the Apache's own ponies obscured the view of the meager force chasing them. They chased the Indians for 10 miles before Jason called them off.
That's it, man! Enough!
They stopped there, 10 miles to the southeast of the town, sat there on their blowing horses, and watched the cloud of dust behind the Apache grow smaller and more distant.
That ought to hold the bastards for a while!
Yeah, it better.
Jason reined his mare around. Their group had dwindled in number. Where there had once been 30, there were now barely 20 riders. And they were all haggard and soaked through with sweat. Some were bloody. Several of them had taken arrows, but they had made it to the end. They had run the game to ground, and they were happy beneath the grime and gore that streaked them.
Come on, let's get back and pick up our dead.
It's just me!
Oh.
Jenny watched as Matt climbed up the ladder and released the bolt on the trap door, then threw it wide.
It's all right, missus. Sheriff Fury stopped by. Said they chased the Indians away to the south. Don't look like they'll be back.
Is he still here? The sheriff, I mean.
He said he had to go back to town. Had to catch up to his men, he said. Said to give you his very best regards, ma'am.
How kind.
How much damage to the town?
Some. Said they burnt out the milchers. Did damage to the livery and some of the south buildings, but they got it in hand.
Was anyone hurt?
Said his deputy took an arrow, but he's on the mend. Cooper, Swayze, Thorpe, and a bunch of others all dead. Got a lot more wounded, though. The wall held up fine. Oh, your sister's fine, too, boss. Said she helped Mrs. Morelli cook up a good stew last night for the whole town.
Just like when we were trailing out.
Suddenly, more than anything, Jenny wanted to see her brother. She wanted to touch his beautiful face and see for herself that he was alive. She wanted to hug Megan tight and help her and Olympia cook a stew for everybody. She wanted to be someplace, any place but here, any place but with Matthew.
Curly, do you think my brother wanted us to come into town?
No, ma'am, I don't think so. Said they'd be fine now that the Indians have took to the hills.
Just the same, tomorrow's Monday. I'll be going into the bank. You can come along with me if you like, Jenny.
Jenny just nodded at him. Without any further conversation, she walked into the kitchen.